That was a clip from the new Broadway production Allegiance, a New American Musical. It's set on the West Coast during the World War II internment of Japanese Americans and was inspired in part by the true life experiences of George Takei, who also stars in the musical. The show is in previews right now and will be open early next month. So we thought we'd revisit a conversation that I had last year with the Star Trek icon turned multimedia phenomenon. Here's a sampling, edited, of course, by Brooke.
Thank you very much, Anne. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. My partner in conversation today was a young character actor in 1966 when he was cast for a role that would make him instantly pretty obscure, actually. Star Trek is such an enduring worldwide phenomenon that we forget how it struggled as a first-run series, but it enjoyed a cult following that has grown and grown, and with it the fame of steady at the helm, Mr. Sulu. When the series was canceled, the plucky third officer might have been consigned to being famous for being famous. But what happened to his career and continues to happen is a phenomenon as well. He's an actor. He's been in appointed and elective politics in Southern California. He's a passionate advocate for gay Americans and especially marital rights. He's at the forefront of a movement to redress the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. And of late, he has become a social media darling with Facebook likes exceeding 8 million. But it seems that people have been mispronouncing his name for at least 50 years. So here's a little mnemonic trick. Oh my, it's George Takei. Ladies and gentlemen, George Takei. George, I have turned this first question over and over in my head, and what I've come up with is more of an assertion, and I humbly request your comment.
All right.
Dude, what a bizarre career.
Yes, it's true. When I was a very young actor, I cruised around in a pretty cool vehicle called the Starship Enterprise. We have Trekkies here. Live long and prosper. That gave me some kind of, cachet. Together with that came, I thought, a responsibility, because actually my life story begins with December 7th, 1941, when Pearl Harbor was bombed. And overnight, American citizens of Japanese ancestry were looked at with suspicion and fear, and the hysteria grew and grew, where President Franklin Delano Roosevelt used Executive Order 9066, which ordered all Japanese Americans to be summarily rounded up and put in 10 barbed wire prison camps, simply because we happened to look like the people that bombed Pearl Harbor. And I remember the barbed wire fence, the sentry towers with the machine guns pointed at us. I remember the searchlight that followed me when I made the night runs to the latrine from our barrack. But I thought it was kind of nice that they lit the way for me to pee. It became normal for me to go with my father to a mass shower, line up three times a day to eat lousy food in a noisy mess hall, go to school in a black tar paper barrack, begin the day with the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. That's what made me an activist. I've been an activist in the social justice movement, in political campaigns, marched with Dr. Martin Luther King, was in the peace movement during the Vietnam War, was engaged in the redress movement for Japanese Americans. Concurrently, I was pursuing an acting career, and I was able to parlay whatever microphone or camera that Star Trek offered me to amplify my voice on the issues that I was campaigning for.
You had a bully star pulpit.
A galactic pulpit.
I feel kind of silly now, but I want to ask you some questions about Star Trek. It made you immortal.
Not really. You know, we had 7 regular characters, and I was like the 4th banana.
Hey, live long and prosper over there. Is he or is he not immortal?
Did I hear immoral? Well, a little bit of that, too.
Now, as I was saying earlier, people forget that the show really struggled, and it was getting clobbered week after week by, like, Gomer Pyle USMC.
You know what the lowest rated episode we ever had was? Where Captain Kirk kissed Uhura, a white man kissing an African-American woman. All the stations in the American South, in Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, refused to air it. And so our ratings plummeted. It was because Star Trek was using science fiction as a metaphor for contemporary issues of the time. And those people that became Star Trek fans watched to see what was the subtext of each episode.
The crew of the Enterprise included a black woman, Uhura, a Russian, Chekhov, a Scotsman, Spock, who I think was a twofer, both Vulcan and Asperger's, and one closeted gay Japanese-American.
That was a hidden special.
Was Gene Roddenberry a multicultural visionary or an intergalactic tokenist? What was he up to?
I think he was both. But he was extraordinary in that he was both. Because as you say, you know, at that time, what they had on television was Gomer Pyle and I Love Lucy, which I love too, but they were pure entertainment. Gene Roddenberry felt that television was being wasted, that it had the potential for enlightenment, and even inspiration.
One of your key areas is marital rights. You came out in 2007, right?
2005. In 2005, both houses of the California State Legislature passed the Marriage Equality Bill. However, at that time, our governor was a movie star, Arnold Schwarzenegger. He ran by saying, "I'm from Hollywood, I've worked with gays and lesbians. Some of my best friends are." And I must say, a couple of my gay friends did vote for him because of that statement. But his base was the conservative right-wing Republican base. And so when the bill came to his desk, he vetoed it. That got me so angry. You know, my blood was boiling that I felt I needed to speak out. And for me to speak out, my voice needed to be authentic. And so I spoke to the press for the first time as a gay man.
After Arnold Schwarzenegger decided to do
Rinegar, that. Yes. Yeah.
You were 68 when you came out.
Mm-hmm. I could not have had a career if I were out. No producer would hire you. So I was closeted for most of my life. I was out to family and very close friends, and my Star Trek colleagues knew. At the end of the week, we would have our wrap parties, and the beer would be rolled out, and the pizza would be brought in, and people would bring their wives or husbands or boyfriends or girlfriends with them, and I frequently had buddies with me. And so, you know, my colleagues are hip. They said, "Oh, George, I get it, you know." But they also know that if they spoke about it, they would damage my career. So, you know, my colleagues knew. But in 2005, when Arnold Schwarzenegger vetoed the bill, I had to speak out. And I was mindful of the fact that it would probably have an adverse impact on my career. But as it turned out, it blossomed. And I was being cast in TV episodes as a character named George Takei. And that character was gay. So I was playing gay George Takei.
You played gay George Takei on the Howard Stern Show, and it's been a wonderful platform for you.
Well, after I came out, we got a phone call from Howard Stern's office offering me the job of being their official announcer. You know, here I've been going out on speaking tours to universities and various other corporate gatherings on marriage equality. But I was essentially talking to allies or people who are LGBT, people that are already with us. In the United States, we have a large, broad middle that are decent, fair-minded people that are too busy to really think about issues other than their next paycheck. Those are the people that we want to get to in order to change the social climate. And Howard Stern has that audience. So I said, let's boldly go where I've never been before. But I'm an actor, not a radio announcer. So I agreed to do it a week every 3 months. And I had fun. It's a party, which begins very early in the morning. And I became a hit on the Howard Stern Show. Who knew?
Who knew? Oh, my.
Oh, my, indeed.
Is that where it came from?
When I first met him, and this was long before the invitation to be his announcer, I was doing a play in New York. And when you're doing a play, the publicist gives you a list of promotional missions. And that particular morning, I had this address on Madison Avenue. I went there, leafing through some magazines, and they had this radio show on. I said to the guy sitting next to me, why can't they get some nice music? That discussion on the air is disgusting. And he said, that's the show we're waiting to go on. I thought, good Lord. And then that's when they came and got me. I walked in, and here's this skinny guy with wild hair. And I said, good morning to him. And he said, oh, you have a deep voice. Anyone with a voice that deep has to have a big dong. I said, are we on the air? And he said, yes. And I said, oh, my. And he had that on tape. And so from that point on, when someone says or does something outrageous, he presses that button, and my voice, oh, my, comes on. And now he's made it my signature.
I don't remember the last time anyone had a catchphrase. Fred Flintstone, Yabba Dabba Doo. Jimmy Walker, Dynamite, and then nothing until, oh, my.
Jimmy Durante, good night, Mrs. Calabash, wherever you are.
Wow, you have just dated yourself.
I'm 77 and proud of it.
I want to come back to those 4 years in the internment camp, mostly in Arkansas, and then I guess later back on the West Coast. Obviously, when you're taking the Pledge of Allegiance to the country that is put you behind barbed wire, even a little child understands the bitter irony of that. Now, 70-some years later, you're working on a political level, but you are also working on an artistic level. You have a musical, Allegiance, that is opening on Broadway in the next season. Tell me about Allegiance.
Allegiance is about one Japanese-American family during the time of the internment. When Pearl Harbor was bombed, young Japanese-Americans, like all young Americans, rushed to their recruitment centers to volunteer to serve in the military. That act of patriotism was answered with a slap in the face. And then they imprisoned us. But a year into imprisonment, the government realized that there is a wartime manpower shortage. And so they came down with another cruel and degrading program called the Loyalty Questionnaire. It was a series of questions, but the most intimidating and enraging question was, will you swear your loyalty to the United States of America and forswear your loyalty to the Emperor of Japan? The word forswear assumes that we have an inborn, existing, genetic loyalty to the Emperor. So if you answered no, you were answering no to the first part, will you swear your loyalty to the United States? If you answered yes, you were then confessing that you had been loyal to the Emperor and we're now willing to set that aside and swear your loyalty to the United States. My parents said, I am not going to grovel before this government. They both answered no, which had them categorized as disloyal. And then there's another group who swallowed their pride and answered that question the way the government wanted them to. And the men were put into a segregated all-Japanese-American unit. The women were put into the WACs. And they were sent to the European battlefields. And they came back to the United States as the most decorated unit of the entire Second World War. And it's this story that we tell in the context of one family in Allegiance. We broke all box office records, in part my social media campaign. I started my social media campaign primarily for Allegiance.
And now you're, you know, the Ashton Kutcher of senior citizens.
This day is an important day for me. I'll never be any younger than I am now.
Ladies and gentlemen, George Takei.
Thank you very much.
This has been a podcast edition of On the Media. There's plenty more where this came from, so keep an eye on our feed and check out our newsletter at onthemedia.org.